Mr. Lorry, Reel 5. I think that whilst you're at Marlag, of all things, you managed to get involved with a swarm of bees.
Oh, yes. Well, for a short period of time, whilst some alterations were being made in our compound, in the improvements to the washing facilities, etc., we were over in the officers' compound, and I was walking around one day with one of the officers who told me that he had found a swarm of bees. And as it happened, I had some interest in this because my father was a beekeeper, as a hobby. Knew a bit about them. I knew some about the technique of collecting a swarm when it had landed on, say, a blackthorn bush or any other object. From that swarm, you could then build up and become a nucleus of a new hive of bees. So he passed this over to me, only a number of bees, a swarm in a wooden box. In order to do anything, of course, with them, one needed equipment, honeycomb and so on, proper hive. In other words, proper equipment that a beekeeper would normally use so that they could be looked after properly. I tried, through the commandant, to get some of this equipment, but his answer passed down the line was that he himself was interested in beekeeping, but as he was unable to get it, of course there was obviously no chance of me getting it. The bees therefore just had to be left in this box, and they reverted virtually to the wild state. In other words, they just made their built a comb, rather like where a swallow builds a nest, and there, of course, they virtually became just wild bees, and I don't know what happened to them in the end, probably just moved on elsewhere.
You were talking earlier about the cooking of food in camp, but I think that various ingenious devices were made for cooking. Can you tell me about those?
Well, one device was known as a blower. Very straightforward description of what it was. In fact, when fuel was short for cooking, someone had the idea of making this device from some empty tins. In fact, it was purely a small handle which drove blades inside this larger tin. In other words, it's just a small hand-driven fan, in effect.
Inside a metal cylinder.
That's right, yes. It could be made, say, two... we used to have tins which contained Klim milk from Canada, powdered milk, and they were a very convenient size for this sort of thing, about the size of a large Lyle's syrup tin.
Ten Lyle's,
yes, so
golden syrup.
Yes, so one tin placed on top of the other, and with this small fan arrangement at the bottom, a small handle, and by feeding in a cigarette packet torn up into small pieces, dropped in once one piece was lit, and as the upper part could hold a cup, a tin of water, you could boil up enough water for a cup of tea and a cigarette packet. The heat that was generated by the action of turning this handle was sufficient to very quickly heat up the water.
Would it actually boil?
Yes, it'd get up to, if not boiling point, very near, and One isn't very fussy about whether it's actually boiling as long as it's hot. Like, the only snag about this was that it created a lot of smoke, so it wasn't very suitable for use indoors. But I can remember sitting outside my room on a cold winter's day with an overcoat on, working this blower and boiling up three small carrots. This is quite true. I had a small garden there. The ground was very barren. It's a pity. If it had been better, we might have been able to have made some decent gardens and helped with vegetable produce. But I had this very small plot, and I managed to grow a few carrots, and I was sitting outside virtually freezing trying to boil up these carrots on his blower. It worked.
How long would a cupful of water take to heat up with the burning of a cigarette packet? Just a few seconds?
Virtually, yes, because, you know, it doesn't take long, obviously, for that amount of carbon or paper to burn. It's just a very short time. Probably sitting outside with the temperatures round about being low and trying to boil carrots, it probably took a bit longer. More cigarette packets or other.
And people would sell these blowers to each other, would they?
I can't remember really how many of them would be around. There was one in this room that I was in, so I expect someone did in fact go into a small business, make a few.
Were you still in Marlag when liberation came?
Not strictly speaking in Marlag, we were further up the hill in Mealang, the Merchant Navy camp. What happened early in 1945, the airmen from Stalagluft 3, the camp where the famous for the Great Escape, they were moved westwards and put into our camp. In order to make room for them, we were moved up the hill a few hundred yards and put in with the Merchant Navy camp, a very large camp. There's some 4,000 people representing about 40 nationalities, mainly British, but from the merchant ships, of course, we had men of all races. The move up there, I think the Germans were beginning to feel the pressure all round. It was getting near to the end of the war, or at least many of us thought so, and we were to some extent integrated with the Merchant Navy men. We were put into separate buildings, but there's quite a bit of movement. Some moved into other rooms and vacancies occurred and so on. So, because the Germans never really decreed where one, which room a person should stay in. In other words, when we were down in Marlag, we tended after a while to perhaps seek a transfer from one room to another. People of similar interests would gather, and the room that I was in for most of my stay in Marlag consisted of chaps with similar interests, doing school work, and one or two were interested in theatricals and so on. Others might be in the same room because they were on, had been on the same ship and so on. But when we went up into Mealag, we mixed in quite a bit with the Merchant Navy people, which was a good thing as it turned out, because after a short while there, the Germans decided to sort out all the naval people and get them onto the road to march towards Lübeck, up on the, towards the Danish frontier. I'm not sure why they wanted to move us, but quite the RAF chaps had moved into our section of Marlag, but the officers' compound had still been occupied by our people, so they were able to get them out fairly easily. But when it came to getting us out, all the mercenary camp, a great difficulty, because we were intermingled so much with the merchant navy men. Some were rooted out and put on the road to march towards Lubeck. We found out a little later that the column of men on the road consisted of a group of Germans, a group of prisoners of war, and a group of Germans, and so on. Probably made by the Germans to look like a large group of prisoners of war. However it was seen from the air, what did in fact happen was that that column was bombed or attacked in some way by our aircraft, or perhaps by the Americans, I don't know by whom, but in fact several of our officers were killed in that march. So we were fortunate in that we were able to stay in the camp. I spent about 24 hours under this hut that I was staying in, sort of hiding away from the guards, and under this hut, which was sandy ground, was a depth sufficient for me to lie under the hut, but it was also sufficient for a German, obviously for a German dog to get its head in there, and I actually saw this German dog on its chain, the guard, and it looked under the hut, and whether it liked the appearance of me, I don't know, but it kept quiet, where I would have expected it to bark and for me to be hauled out and put out on the road to march away, but so managed to escape that. There was a point, a bit unfortunate about that time, where of course rumours were rife all the time when I was in a camp. The least bit of news from anywhere was seized upon and very often passed around until it bore no resemblance to how it started off. Rumours were right. One rumour was that the war was finished, all over. And some, I think they were Egyptians or Greeks, I'm not sure. And for some reason they decided to build a little fire outside and make themselves a cup of tea or some sort of celebration. So there was no fact behind their behind this rumour, and the plane came across one of these rocket firing ones, I think, and then came and it demolished part of the hut, I believe, and a few of these chaps were killed. Then again, there was no blame could be put on the pilots of the planes when they saw this light appearing. But time then was, of course, getting near. Into March, April of 45, and one got more and more snips of news, and then we could actually hear the guns of the advancing army. And we were virtually surrounded by British forces who were moving up, I think, from the Hanover direction and east from the Hamburg direction, until we were virtually in a sort of pocket. And at one point we dug trenches to shield ourselves from possible splinters from mortar bombs from our own forces, as they were firing these over the camp towards from a road south of the camp, over the camp towards a road north of the camp. In fact, no one was injured, I think, but we dug ourselves in a bit there. Then one fine day, up rolled a jeep, and armoured cars, tanks, other vehicles. The British Armoured Guards Division, Guards Armoured Division, I think they call themselves, had liberated us. And in this jeep was a young naval lieutenant who, in fact, had been, who was the commanding officer of the MTB at Saint-Nazaire. He was badly wounded. He lost an eye, in fact. He'd been repatriated. And I suppose that really he shouldn't have been out there at all. Because once one is repatriated on medical grounds, I think that is virtually the end as far as taking part in further military operations. But he was out there in this jeep flying a white ensign. We hoisted a white ensign in the camp, of course. We had an organisation set up. In no time we had an officer of the watch and a man the gate to take over from the Germans, who very quickly disappeared, except for one or two.
How was the victorious invading army behaving in Germany?
That I wouldn't know anything about at all, I don't think. As far as treating the civilian population and so on, I wouldn't have any knowledge at all. I don't suppose we would hear anything. You know, I suppose we sound selfish, but we were concerned, obviously, on our release, and as far as we were concerned, they were winning the war against the German army. I would imagine that from what I've heard from other sources, I think that our troops on the whole behaved pretty well. But you might hear the odd story otherwise. I did see some refugees, German refugees, coming along the road on, like, with hand carts and so on, old people and very young people, who obviously I would think they were fleeing from the east towards the west, and it's not a nice thing to see at all. People who have that rather hopeless look on their faces, you don't know quite where they're going. But I think I could say quite confidently that when they got through to the British lines, see, I said the British were coming from the east and the south, but then of course they'd also be coming around from the west. We were virtually in a pocket, and I think that they would be treated all right. I never heard any Germans complaining about the any treatment by our people. On the other hand, it's probably it's not a question we'd have asked anyone. You know, we're concerned about getting back, and so within we left the camp in order of time spent there. Those who'd been there longest went first. So I went about the second day, and taken to an army camp at Diepholz. Then
Diepholz.
Diepholz, and from there we're flown to Brussels, and from Brussels back to this country in the Lancaster bomber, which was a very pleasant trip. And so we arrived back, and I actually arrived home on VE Day, which was very nice when the celebrations were about to begin. for the end of that part of the war.
How did your relatives and friends receive you when you got back? Were they interested in your experiences, or did they not want to talk about it?
Oh yes, very. I'm sure they were all interested, and in my own small village, I was the only one actually in the Navy. I was there was one other young fellow who had been in the army and who was a prisoner of war. There were a few others from surrounding farms, so on, who were in the Navy, but I believe I was the only prisoner of war in that little area, only naval one. Because earlier, when my mother first was informed that I was a prisoner of war, some 6 weeks or so after I was taken prisoner, by the time all the information got through via Geneva, etc., and she, of course, was then contacted by the local Red Cross organisation, and the army colonel who was overseeing things, he said to my mother, "Well, I didn't know we had any naval chaps or prisoners of war in the area, but the nearest naval man to myself at that time during the war was in fact an admiral who was in charge of the invasion of D-Day preparations, Admiral Ramsay."
You mean he lived near your village, did he?
Yes, just about 2 miles away. He unfortunately was killed at the war.
After you got back, did the POWs who had been in the hands of the Germans make any attempt to associate with each other formally?
Well, I resumed my career in the Navy, but during the latter part of 1945 and the early months of 46, I was attending a college in the London area, and there was in fact an association set up, the British Returned Prisoners of War Association, headquarters in London, and we used to meet in a nice part of London. They had various social functions organised, dances and so on. I think they did quite a lot of good work from a welfare point of view, where they were able to find out where people needed help. But unfortunately, we had a magazine which was published periodically. I still have a few of them, and so I attended quite a few functions, but it appeared to peter out after 2-3 years. I would imagine the main reason was the fact that so many were not, of course, resident in the London area, and whilst I was here, obviously I was interested. When I moved away, I'd probably find there was no association elsewhere. Probably, like some associations, for example, the British Legion, with branches all over the country, had we had something like that, it might have survived in the way that the Far East Prisoner of War Association has survived. There again, the hardships endured out there, etc., may have made them cling more closely to each other. But from time to time, I meet those I encounter alone. There are 3 or 4 of us now who were in the same camp. But, well, 3 of us, another one who's down near Portsmouth I'm in touch with, but we haven't actually got an association as such.
Do you think that your period of imprisonment left any long-term effects on you in any way, either physically or in your attitudes or whatever?
Not physically, I don't think. I think that when I refer to again the Far East, that there the physical effects were pretty terrible on some of the men. Probably was on some of our people from Germany, but no, it didn't affect me that way, or mentally either. But I must say that when I came back after 3 years over in Germany, I found life strange in many ways. Yes, I suppose it was strange, the fact of getting back into an open community and, you know, having to queue up for buses and this and that, and generally get back into a normal way of living. I think the life teach all of us one or two things, that, no man is can sort of get along on his own for too long. I think that, you know, you really need your friends with you, and you get this a great feeling of comradeship, you know, something you get in the services in general, and particularly on a ship, a small ship. But I think as prisoners of war, that you really had very often to depend on each other, and you know, you'd I've seen for example, you wouldn't find a chap. I was fairly lucky in that my relatives, friends would send me tobacco. I used to smoke a pipe and so on, but there were some chaps who for some reason or other very few parcels, and you wouldn't see that chap go without. Perhaps you might not at home, civilian life, but there, I think the amount of help that one would give to another was, you know, paramount. That there's and a lot of, I think, friendships were formed there too, from meeting under conditions like that.
Has your experience as a POW left you with any feelings towards the Germans?
Not particularly. I said before, on the whole, we were treated quite, you know, decently. After all, if a war is being fought, you don't expect to be softly treated, I think. On the other hand, although, say, on the whole, we were treated quite well, I wouldn't forget the fact that many people were very badly treated. Only a few miles from where we were places like Auschwitz or Buchenwald, places like that. We had no knowledge of them then. And I dare say it might be true that a lot of the Germans themselves didn't know, the ordinary soldier or sailor who was looking after us. But I don't think that you know, these sort of things should be forgotten. And so, you know, it's always difficult now to find, say, a German who would say that he knew anything about such things going on. Obviously, a lot of the younger generation, it's probably quite genuine when they say, well, they didn't know about it, or they can't believe it happened. But I dislike him because he's a German. I think my philosophy is that there are probably many good Germans, and there probably were many good Germans in those days, just as there are good and bad in every race. No, I'm not particularly biased or prejudiced in any way, I don't think.